Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Jnana Timirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmahe Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manovishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Karamayam Vidati Svapadandikam Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Samhirniti Namine Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvisesha Shunavadi Pashyapyaheshatadine Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vahari Gaur Bhaktarinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Hare Krishna. So, from what I understand, we're on chapter 3, text 29, is that correct? 30, okay. Chapter 3, 30. Okay, good. I hope you don't mind if I kind of work a little bit for 29 because I did some background work and I was really looking forward to giving class on 3:29 because it's a verse that always has confused me. At least the purport has. Before I start, I would just like to offer all my gratitude and obeisances to devotees here in Connecticut, especially Jory Mohan and his crew here, everyone that is part of making this yatra possible. Krishna consciousness is very precious, and anyone trying to engage in Krishna consciousness and push it on by knowledge or making facilities or trying to hold regular programs is very dear to the Supreme Lord. So I appreciate all the efforts of the devotees here. And I want to offer any apologies I may have for any offenses I may have committed in being here before or any of those kind of things. So please overlook my transgressions. It's very nice. I don't think I've ever given class here before, as far as I remember. I've been at a couple of the Rath Yatras, but I've never, as far as I know, given class at this temple here. The verse, I'll read verse 29 and talk a little bit about that, and then I'll go on to 30. Prakritir guna samudha sajante guna karmasu Tana Krishna vidho madan, Krishna vinna vichayet. Bewildered by the three modes of material nature, the ignorant fully engage themselves in material activities and become attached, but the wise should not unsettle them, although these duties are inferior due to the performer's lack of knowledge. Again, I'll read that. Bewildered by the modes of material nature, the ignorant fully engage themselves in material activities and become attached, but the wise should not unsettle them, although these duties are inferior due to the performer's lack of knowledge. So, chapter 3 on Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is making an effort to remove Arjuna's main misconception. And It's a misconception many people have, and it's a misconception that's very easy to fall into and very hard to become aware that one has a misconception and to change that misconception. Arjuna was not someone who was ignorant of Vedic knowledge. Arjuna spent his childhood in the forest basically with his father and his brothers, and they heard from sages. That was one of the things Maharaj Pandu liked to do. So Arjuna does have some understanding of Vedic knowledge. In fact, anyone who was a Kshatriya, especially during that time, had to grow up with Vedic knowledge, because it was understood they would have to use that knowledge as they got older in the process of ruling and in the process of administering justice. So Arjuna certainly had a basic understanding of Vedic knowledge, but like many people, Arjuna did not have a deep knowledge of Vedic, of what the real purpose of Vedic understanding really is. Of course, he was Krishna's friend. So, because he was Krishna's friend, he had an internal, innate understanding of Vedic knowledge. But from a philosophy point of view, he didn't have a spiritual master up to that point. In fact, we find that in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna accepts Krishna as a spiritual master. And so Krishna understands all this, and he takes the first six chapters of Bhagavad Gita as an effort to kind of cover all the bases in Vedic knowledge. He goes over all the main ideas and all the main systems and all the main processes in Vedic knowledge over the first six chapters. And at the end of the sixth chapter, Krishna finally gets around to telling Arjuna what he really wants Arjuna to do, now that everything is out on the table. That way, they're on the same page. That way, everything has been talked about. So there's no idea that, well, what about this? We didn't talk about this yet. How does this fit into the picture? So that's what's really happening over the first six chapters. It took me a long time to understand that, and by the mercy of other devotees, I became aware of that basic layout of the Bhagavad Gita, that it takes about six chapters for Krishna to finally explain the full view of Vedic activities. And then in the end of the sixth chapter, Krishna gets around to telling Arjuna what he really wants him to do. But what Arjuna is under the misimpression of, many people are under the misimpression of, that what we need to do to be spiritual is to stop working. And this is the misconception that Arjuna has. We have this idea of a yogi sitting somewhere on a mountaintop, you know, with no possessions, simply meditating. And we think, this must be the perfect example of spiritual life. And Arjuna had this basic concept. In fact, he suggests that he's supposed to meditate to Krishna instead of fighting this battle of Kurukshetra. But Krishna is saying no, that this is not the perfect example of spiritual life. Rather, he wants Arjuna to work, but he wants Arjuna to work in Krishna consciousness. So Arjuna is not supposed to give up work. He's supposed to give up the fruit of work, which is a very different thing. And chapter 3 opens with that basic question: why do you urge me to engage in this ghastly warfare if you say knowledge is better than fruit of work? So that's how Arjuna starts the chapter. And then at this point, Krishna is explaining about various aspects of duty, and he's talking about different kinds of comprehension of duty, finally to the highest kind of duty. So we look at this verse again, 29. Bewildered by the modes of nature, the ignorant fully engage themselves in material activities and become attached. But the wise should not settle them, although these duties are inferior due to the performer's lack of knowledge. This verse 29 goes back to verse 26, where we have a very similar thing being said. So as not to disrupt the minds of ignorant men attached to fruitive results of prescribed duty, a learned person should not induce them to stop work. Rather, by working in a spirit of devotion, he should engage them in all sorts of activities for the gradual development of Krishna consciousness. So what these two verses are describing is something that gets called technically karma mishra bhakti. So bhakti yoga is the idea of doing everything for Krishna. Karma yoga is the idea of performing pious activities according to some scripture, that are, these pious activities are moral and they're in keeping with God. However, the real purpose of these pious activities is to get God to deliver our material desires to us. That's karma yoga. And so we discussed this morning a little bit about the idea of karma yoga. There are different stages of spiritual realization. I won't go into detail, but I'll just mention that the bottom stage is what we call animal life, where humans have no scruples about what they do or why they do it. They just want to be happy, and they're ready to do anything to be happy. Above that is karma yoga. We can call it that for short. And karma yoga is where people perform material activities, but they do it in a scriptural way. They follow scriptural rules, and they do various types of rituals. And in this way, they hope God will give them what they actually want in their heart. God is in there, but he's in there only indirectly. He's the person that supplies the material desire. Then above that is what we call jnana yoga, which is people who discover that material life is not what it appears to be. It's not really satisfying. And they begin to look for something mysterious that's behind the whole universe. That's jnana yoga. Then above that we have what we call astanga yoga, where people are not really looking for anything. They understand that this something that's behind the universe can be found by a mystic process, and that mystic process is meditation. So they do that. And then above that is, of course, bhakti yoga. It's not so mysterious anymore. We understand that that mystery behind the universe is a person, and our connection with that person is in service and love, and that's called bhakti yoga. So karma mishra bhakti is a mixture of karma and bhakti. Mishra means to mix, so karma, mishra, bhakti is a mixture of karma and bhakti. And we see this in a lot of places. And in fact, we cannot start bhakti on the pure level. We start bhakti on the level of a mixture with karma. So we may intellectually understand that we want to serve Krishna, and that that's really the goal of life, that serving God is really the goal of life. We may intellectually understand that, but it's a long road. So when we start engaging in bhakti yoga, we still have a lot of karmic influence in the way we do things, in the way we think, and in our habits. But as we find out from these verses, if one stays with the process of bhakti, gradually, the karma is purified out. The karma aspect is purified out. And Prabhupada oftentimes uses an analogy that this is like purifying a metal. If we have gold, it's not usually found in pure form. It's found mixed with other things, with other kinds of impurities, maybe even with other metals. And so we take the gold and we heat it, and there are certain processes that are done. And what we wind up with after we get the gold and we heat it and we move it through various processes is we get pure gold or unalloyed gold. Alloy is a combination of two metals. Brass is an alloy. There are many things that are alloys. So when we get unalloyed devotional service, that means devotional service not mixed with elements of karma and jnana. And so in the beginning, we start off with karma mishra bhakti, but gradually we come to the point where we have pure bhakti. So why this is being described here is that someone who is actually in knowledge, they may see people who are engaged in karma yoga. So people who are engaged in karma yoga should not be discouraged from engaging in karma yoga, but rather they should be encouraged to continue to do ritualistic activities according to the Vedas, but with this idea that now we should add the dimension of spiritual activities as well, activities directed exactly and specifically to Krishna. So that means we have karma yoga, but we are now adding the element of bhakti yoga in there, which will eventually purify out the karma part of it. So this is what these two verses really describe, this little section here. And this kind of confused me for a while, because in the purport, Prabhupada talks about how one should not disturb the minds of those who are engaged in material activities and waste time. And then later on, at the very end of the purport, Prabhupada says that the devotees, knowing the purpose of the Lord, go even so far as to approach ignorant men and disturb them. Basically is what it sounds like he's saying. So this may be confusing. Are we supposed to disturb them? Are we not supposed to disturb them? Krishna appears to be saying we shouldn't disturb them. Prabhupada appears to be saying we should disturb them. And this is what kind of confused me for a while. And then I realized that basically they're both saying the same thing, but they're just using a little bit of a different terminology and they're talking about a different aspect. When Krishna says we shouldn't disturb them, he means that people who are engaged in karma yoga and are convinced of karma yoga and will not move up into bhakti yoga even a little bit, such people, we shouldn't worry with them, nor should we discourage them from doing karma yoga, because doing karma yoga is better than not doing karma yoga, which is animal life. That's the step below, not the step above. It's the step below karma yoga. So we shouldn't disturb them in that way by suggesting that they stop action. And people who are very materially attached will not make the grade if they jump to jnana or to Ashtanga yoga. It won't work for them. They're too materially attached, so if they bring their material attachment to suddenly jnana yoga or to suddenly Ashtanga yoga, it'll be a farce. It won't work. So they should be encouraged to continue doing what they're doing, and then hopefully at some time in the future they'll be able to grasp the principle of bhakti yoga and begin to add bhakti yoga. And as they add bhakti yoga, the karma yoga will be destroyed and bhakti yoga will emerge purified of the karmic side. Now when Prabhupada says we shouldn't, that the devotees follow and even they know the purpose of the Lord, so they even approach such materially conditioned people. Basically, almost everybody in the world is in this category. There's so many people who are performing karma yoga. I was mentioning this morning that probably between animal life and karma yoga, that's 98% of the people in the world. Even religious people, they may talk and use words that suggest bhakti yoga, but 98% of what they're doing is karma yoga. They are actually waiting for God to fulfill their material desires instead of wanting to serve God. they give lip service to the idea of service of God and love of God, but really their idea is that I'm a good Christian, I'm a good Jew, I'm a good Muslim, I'm a good Hindu, because I perform these rituals, and because I perform these rituals, then God will give me what I want. This morning we were calling that the waitress version of God, that God is our waitress. We have a menu, we go down and sit at a restaurant, and we look and say, I would like a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and God shows up and says, okay, that's your order, we'll take it back to the kitchen and we'll whip it right up for you. There's also, I call it sometimes, the Santa Claus version of God, where we have this idea of, you know, Judy wants a pair of skates, Jimmy wants a sled, you know, we have all these kind of ideas of what we want, and God is the person who's supposed to, like a genie in a lamp, you know, make it happen. And this is the real essence of karma yoga. God is not there for us to serve. God is there so that we can do the things that appear to be what he says he wants, and now he's supposed to serve us. And at some point we recognize that's really not the real purpose of religion, and we come to bhakti yoga. So, because most people are in this classification, devotees go throughout society and they try to meet those people who might be influenced to move one step higher into bhakti yoga. And so they give them this knowledge. And some take to it, some do not. That's the way it is, because people have free will. And in that sense, we are disturbing them from their karma yoga, but we don't know. They might be able to take a step forward into bhakti yoga once they hear that bhakti yoga is higher. They don't have to change their religion. They don't have to change their way of life in many ways, but they do have to understand what bhakti yoga is, and they have to begin doing bhakti yoga and understand the fault of being rooted in karma yoga. So in that way we do approach them. Of course, if they are negative about it, then we simply back away, because there's no point in trying to push someone to understand or follow something that they don't agree or accept or want to follow. As the saying goes, a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. So in the modern world, you can give people great reasons and arguments and try to reason with them. But ultimately, they have to accept it. If they don't, there's nothing you can do. And there's no point in trying to do anything further, because they are committed to their rung on the yoga ladder. They're committed to karma yoga. They don't want to go to jnana yoga. They don't want to go to astanga yoga. They don't certainly want to go to bhakti yoga either. They're happy with karma yoga, and that's where they're going to stay. So one other simple thing I would mention is that there's a nice verse in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam that describes, you know, Ishvare tadadineshu baliseshu dvisatsucha prema maitre kripopeksha ya karoti sa madhyamaha. And this is describing the madhyam adhikari. And Prabhupada suggested that this is the way we should interact with the world. And the classical way that a madhyam adhikari interacts with others is fourfold. There's four categories of people, and there's four categories of interaction. Ishvare, Taradineshu, Baliseshu, and Visatsu. Excuse me. And then there's four types of interaction: prema, maitre, kripa, and upeksha. So these are four ways of interaction. So Ishvare is Ishvara, the Supreme Lord. That's one category of persons. The Supreme Lord is a category all in himself. So Ishvare, Taradineshu, is the devotees, those who are also have accepted the process of bhakti yoga. Baliseshu is those people who have not yet quite understood spiritual life. They're called the Baliseshu. And Dvisatsu. Dvisatsu are the envious. So how does the devotee, the Madhyamadhikari, relate to these four categories? by prema, maitri, kripa, and upeksha. So prema is love. That's how he relates to Ishvara, the Supreme Lord. He relates to the Supreme Lord in love. Tadadineshu, the devotees, he maitri, he becomes their friend. He's friendly with them. The balisheshu, or the not so spiritually advanced, he gives them kripa, or mercy. He preaches to them, so he gives them mercy. And as far as the dvisatsu, the envious, he upeksha, he ignores them. So that's the way that the Madhyamadikari relates to these four categories. And so this is a good thing always to keep in mind. We can approach anyone and everyone, but once they make their own reaction understood, then we know what to do next. We back off, or we continue, or any number of things. So this is basically how the Madhyamadikari works. So now we'll go over to the next verse. Verse 330. Mai sarvani karmani sanyas yatma chetasa nirashir nirmamo buddha yudyasva vigatajvara. Therefore, O Arjuna, surrendering all your works unto me with full knowledge of me, without desire for profit, and with no claims to proprietorship, free from lethargy, fight. So here Krishna is trying to describe what he means by bhakti yoga, what he means by working for him. So someone has knowledge of Krishna, someone is working for Krishna, and someone is not claiming to be the proprietor. And he's active. He's not sitting in some meditational posture. He's actually active. So this is what Krishna is trying to give Arjuna the clear picture of. And if you have trouble with it, you're in good company, because Arjuna obviously had trouble with it as well. The beginning of the third chapter, Arjuna asks the question, why do you urge me to engage in this ghastly warfare if you say knowledge is better than fruit of work? We see at the beginning of chapter 5, Arjuna says almost the same question again. So Arjuna didn't get it yet. You know, he heard chapter 3, he heard chapter 4, and he still basically got this same misconception. But in chapter 5, Arjuna basically gets it. But Krishna hammers the idea home at least two or three more times, the same basic point, that we are not to give up work, we are to give up the fruit of work. It's a very different thing. By giving up the fruit of work means we are working, but we are not claiming the result. In mundane karma yoga, we are working, and then we have some fruit, and the idea is that now that we've worked and we have some fruit, we can enjoy the fruit. We'll take the fruit and we'll do whatever we imagine we want to do with it. What do we imagine we want to do with it? That is part of our baggage from many lifetimes that we've brought with us. We imagine, I want to be this, I want to go here, I want to have this experience, I want to be looked at and in this type of pedestal. People are going to worship me for this reason. And then we take the money or whatever resources we get through our work and we apply it to those material desires that we have carried with us for many times, many years, and even many lifetimes. But that's exactly what bhakti yoga is learning to not do. We're learning that the fruit of our work doesn't go to follow these rainbows and these various mirages that we have constructed for ourselves in many lifetimes. Rather, the fruit of our work is intended to go for Krishna. And in the beginning, we find that hard to get used to. In fact, many of us find that very terrifying even. But over time, we begin to realize that it isn't as bad as we thought, and we, by degrees, learn how to give a bigger and bigger chunk to Krishna. And as we do, we realize we didn't disappear. Our life didn't burn up. We didn't fall in a hole. They didn't have to take us away in an ambulance. That we can still live. But now we're learning how to give more and more to Krishna. And we care less and less about these pipe dreams that we have nurtured for so many lifetimes. And this is, in a simple way, how Krishna is describing this process to Arjuna. Surrender your works to me. In other words, you should work, and your work is for me. With full knowledge, you have to understand what bhakti is. And without desire for profit, and no claim to proprietorship. So we're learning, and this is one of the main points of chapter 3, this idea of how to work for Krishna. We're trying to learn how to work for Krishna. We're trying to learn how to take the fruit and offer it to Krishna. We're learning how to give up these mental concoctions that we have and give more and more to Krishna. And this is the process of bhakti. And it starts with a heavy mixture of bhakti and karma, where we are using some of the fruits of our work for our own material desires. But gradually we learn how to give that up more and more. And then through doing that and practicing the 9 different aspects of bhakti yoga, we become at the stage of giving everything to Krishna. Gradually that's where it comes. By practicing bhakti yoga in the beginning, we have a lot of karma mixed in, but as the years go by, the karma gets separated away, and we wind up with pure bhakti. Of course, by the way, we have to also remove the aspects of jnana and yoga as well. We have to remove those from the process of bhakti for it to be purified. And sometimes those become an obstacle as well, but usually the biggest obstacle is removing the karma element of the karma mishra bhakti and coming to pure bhakti. All right, so that's my basic presentation. I'm going to open up for questions, if anybody has any questions about any of this. I'll try to reply. Or any comments. Yes.
So the basic conception of working for Krishna should be that we could perform the work we do, but the results of the work, which usually is money,
offer
it to Krishna.
Right. We have, every human being has some kind of resources. They have time, they have money, they have intelligence, they have skill. You know, all of us have these things to some extent or another. And we can use them for Krishna. We should use them for Krishna. But most of the time, we use them 99% in our own idea of what we want to do with these things. And with devotional service, we learn how to use them more and more for Krishna and less for ourselves. So if someone has money, they can use that for Krishna. If someone has some kind of skill or knowledge or expertise, they can use that for Krishna. We have time, so even if we don't have any great money or skill or expertise, we can at least use our time by performing simple activities for Krishna. And so in this way, we take our lives where God is a very small percentage of what we do, and that small percentage gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and that is bhakti yoga.
That's a different perspective of the people who follow the Bible, because they talk in there about offering God the 10% of whatever you make.
Yeah. We were talking about that this morning. That's generally the concept. But there are people in every religious background that understand that this idea of karma yoga, a mundane karma yoga for God, is a low level of spiritual realization. The higher level is to give everything to God. And somehow or another, they figure out how to do it. There are a few people, and there's no religious system has a monopoly on these people. These are people who spend their whole lives and everything that they have in 100% service to God. These are very special people. But the rest of us, we may think, oh, they're magical people somehow or another. they became like that. But any one of us can become like that. That's what the process of bhakti yoga is. It's that bridge that takes you from an ordinary person where you give a little bit of your life to God to where you give 100% of your life to God. And that's through the 9 processes of bhakti yoga. And for that matter, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and these other religious paths, they usually do at least pay lip service to this idea that we should love God and give everything to God. But rare is that person who actually does it. You know, rare is that person who starts to make a very serious effort to give more and more to God. But in bhakti yoga, at least in Krishna consciousness, the Bhagavad Gita and Prabhupada's purports and those things, they explain to us that's really the real deal and that's what we should strive to do. And by degrees, we can do it. Yes, you have a question.
So, I see a little, maybe a contradiction here, but maybe you can explain it. Because we get told in here, Krishna doesn't really need
right.
the stuff we're doing. We are the ones that So if we're doing this bhakti yoga, we are getting something that we need, right? It's not like there's no fruits.
Right.
We're getting closer to Krishna, right? We're getting certain kinds of rewards that...
That could be considered a fruit.
It could be something that I would like. You know, you're
right.
talking about us wanting to have what we want back.
Right, right. No one does anything without some sense of reciprocation. But when our reciprocation is to want to please Krishna, that is a purely spiritual motivation. That's a purely spiritual desire. There's nothing wrong with that desire. But when we want something material that's separate from Krishna in some material arrangement, then that is separate. So there's nothing wrong with that desire. Of course, as you were saying, Krishna doesn't need anything. He already has everything. And he's Atmaram. He's self-satisfied. So we are doing things for Krishna, not because Krishna needs them, but because through serving Krishna, we are demonstrating our desire to connect with Krishna. And then little by little, we connect with Krishna. And this is a mysterious but very graduated path. In Rupa Goswami's writings, we find that Ado Shraddha Tata Sayo Sangata Bhajana Kriyata Narta Nivritisya Danishta Ruchis Tata Tava Ata Shakta Tava Tata Prema Vyudam Shati Sadha Kanamayam Prema Nirudaveva Vet Karmaha. He describes that there are 9 stages, and these are stages of coming from having nothing to do with God to being the highest devotee. And so we begin to learn what these stages are, and we begin to see how a lot of things change as we progress through these stages. Shraddha is just faith. We have this faith that there must be some knowledge out there somewhere. And that knowledge will help us to become better people. We don't have anything more clear in our mind than that. But because we have faith, it brings us to stage 2. So first is Shraddha, 1 is faith. Sadhusanga is associating with devotees. We begin to get faith and we associate with those who also have faith and are doing the practice. And so now we are engaged in devotional activities. And we see that it's working for other people, and we see that it's also working for us, so our faith becomes stronger. And then we come to the 3rd stage, which is called Bhajana Kriya, which we call technically taking initiation. At that point, we make a firm commitment to the process, and we accept a spiritual master, so that's Bhajana Kriya. Now, we are not at all completely pure, anything like it at this stage yet. But now we've taken the 3rd step of devotional service, and we're following the plan or the orders of the spiritual master. And by doing that, we get anartha nivritti, which is stage 4. Anarthanivriti means unwanted things in the heart are starting to disappear. Doubts, selfish interests, all kinds of unwanted things, they're beginning to disappear. That's Anarthanivriti. Then when many unwanted things have already vanished from the heart, we come to Nishta, which is steadiness. That's five. When we come to stage five of Nishta, of steadiness, because so many unwanted things are now missing from our consciousness, now we're beginning to appreciate spiritual life, and we're able to be steady at it, Nishta. Then six is Ruchi. Now we actually begin to have a genuine taste for spiritual life. So at this point, the point of Ruchi, we actually like doing devotional service. Before, we knew we should do it. Before, we knew that it was the right thing to do, and sometimes we had to struggle to make ourselves do it because we wanted to do so many different things other than spiritual life. But at the time that we reach this stage, the stage called Ruchi, at that point now devotional service is natural for us, and we like doing it, and we're sincerely and completely uninterested in material activities. So something has really changed by that point. And for that to come, we have to have all the purifying processes that came before. The taking a spiritual master, which was this process called Vajrakriya, the process of getting rid of material unwanted things in the heart, Anarthanivriti. Then we became steady, then we gained a taste. And now we go into the last three stages, which are actually stages where spiritual life is not anymore something we do because we've heard about it or we've learned about it. Now spiritual life is natural, and we're starting to recognize that this material world is false, always has been, it's two-dimensional, and we're starting to connect with that world beyond this material world, the spiritual world. Atta Shakti is the beginning of recognizing our real spiritual identity and our service in the spiritual world. It's called Atta Shakti. And then that's seven. Eight is Bhava, where our actual love for God is no longer a theoretical thing. Now we really do feel love for God. And because we feel such intense love for God, we're automatically doing everything right. And we are automatically uninterested in spiritual life. And now we are sometimes living in two different worlds. We're living in this material world, and we're also living in the spiritual world simultaneously, even before we leave this body. And then prema, the ninth stage, is full-on love of God. At that point, we are living and connecting with Krishna the way we live and connect with each other. So Krishna's there, he talks to us, he has relationships with us, we are being invited and engaged by others, gopis and other people who are part of Krishna's entourage in direct service for Krishna. Even it can happen while we're alive, and that's stage nine. So we see how wide this spectrum goes, all the way from knowing nothing at all about Krishna, all the way up to prema and everything in between. And these stages come as we practice devotional service. So the practicing part of devotional service is called sadhana bhakti, or sometimes vaidhi bhakti. We understand what we should do, and we're doing it. We don't have genuine feeling, but we are following regulations. And then that translates over into ragatmika bhakti, where we have genuine emotion for Krishna. And we have genuine perception of Krishna. We're not just doing things because we were told to do it. We're not doing things because we're taking things on faith. At that time, we actually see Krishna. We're connecting with Krishna. And we're introduced to an intimate relationship with Krishna. And at that stage, life becomes very different. And we have to wait for Krishna to call us into that inner dimension of spiritual life. But we do that by following the other stages, the sadhana bhakti. So Krishna doesn't need the things that we have to do in sadhana bhakti. We're doing it for our own purification. And we understand, theoretically, that by pleasing Krishna, that's the real purpose of the universe. And then as we please Krishna, we may be called eventually into the inner dimension of a relationship with Krishna. And then we have genuine feeling for Krishna. And we forget that Krishna is Krishna. At that stage, something very mysterious happens. When we enter the three higher rasas, then we forget that Krishna is Krishna. And instead, we just think that I like this person, Krishna. I don't know that he's God. I forget that most of the time. As a matter of fact, those who are very intimate with Krishna in the intimate rasas, they don't think of Krishna as God. They just think of Krishna as someone they very much like. Their lives are completely focused on Krishna, and there's a 24/7 drama going on with Krishna in the center. He's the center character. And everybody is doing things with Krishna. Sometimes they're laughing, sometimes they're running, sometimes they're dancing, sometimes they're eating, sometimes there's a festival, sometimes they're looking for Krishna. He appears to have disappeared, and then he reappears again, and so on and so forth. So this is a whole world, and this world goes on. And in that world, there's no more consideration of who's doing who for what, you know, who's doing what for who, rather. There's no consideration like that. Everybody is just trying to have a relationship with Krishna. And we don't think about God anymore. There's no big philosophical ideas. All we're thinking about is that I like what I'm doing. There's Krishna. I want to do something for him. And that's what life is. So if you kind of keep in mind this gradual progression from one stage to another, we begin to see how the world that we live in today, the world that we see today, eventually segues into a very different kind of reality. And the acharyas have described it. So what I was just talking about is the definition or the description of Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He describes these nine steps in devotional service. So, I don't know, maybe that helped answer your question. I don't know, I was kind of long-winded, but...
It did, and my name is Faith, so I liked the beginning part.
Okay.
You said anybody.
Good.
So, all right, so Krishna doesn't need what we're doing, but he is pleased by the stone.
Right.
So it's not like he's not reacting. Mm-hmm. He's just over there, and we're just here.
Right, right. He so doesn't need it. But by learning to be servants of Krishna in a official and a kind of distant way, we become able to enter Krishna's inner pastimes, which are not official, and they're not distant at all. They're very intimate. And at that point, we are doing what the universe really is about. It's not about this material world and our, you know, chasing after various little mirages in the desert. It's not about that. We think it is. And that's the main kind of what all the billboards say in the material world, enjoy the material world in this way and that way, and that's what we're doing. But actually, that's a whole fraud. But it's so all-pervasive in the material world that everybody buys into it. And by serving Krishna a little bit more, we eventually leave that world behind, first conceptually, and then finally we leave the material world. Our soul goes back to the spiritual world, and there we engage with Krishna in the pastimes. And at that point, all these other things cease to matter. Even though Krishna is God, he likes interacting with his devotees as if he was just another person. And that's where the real taste of spiritual life is. And at that point, we don't have any philosophical ideas. We don't need them. And we're just engaged in an ever-unfolding rasa with all kinds of different flavors and with all sorts of different personalities that have different roles in that rasa. So Krishna doesn't need what we do, but he wants to reciprocate with us in an emotional relationship. And so we have to become purified to once again re-enter that relationship. We were once there already, and we left it behind because we wanted to be God ourselves. So we come here, eventually we discover our mistake, and we go back. Oh yeah, you have a question.
Maharaj?
Yeah.
Arjuna, after bombarding Krishna with philosophy, he eventually surrendered in chapter 2. He said, I'm a soul surrendered unto you. Krishna, instruct me. And now, according to you, opposite chapter 6, before he surrendered completely.
And what before?
Chapter 6.
Chapter 6.
So I want you to explain the point at this time. Chapter 2, of the point of chapter 6 where he surrendered completely.
Well, what he does in chapter 6 is Krishna describes what he really wants Arjuna to do. If you look at chapter 6, the next to the last verse is, you know, tapas vibhyo diko yogi. There's that verse that he says, first of all, that the yogi is better than the ascetic. The yogi is better than the jnani. The yogi is better than the fruitive worker. Therefore, in all matters or all cases, be a yogi, Arjuna. So Krishna has gone through all these things, and then he goes to chapter 6 and he makes that statement. And then the statement right after that one is that, and of all yogis, the one who always thinks of me in devotional service is the most intimately united with me and is the highest of all. So we've talked in chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and even in chapter 6, we've discussed Sankhya Yoga, Buddhi Yoga. Krishna's talked about Karma Yoga. He's talked about Jnana Yoga. He's talked about Dhyana Yoga, meditation. He's described all these different things. And then at the end of chapter 6, Krishna winds it all up like a summary, and he says, if you look at 6, whatever that is, next to the last verse of chapter 6, we have tapas vibhyo diko yogi jnanibhyo pimato dikaha karmabhyas chadiko yogi tasmad yogi bhavarjana. Yogi is greater than the ascetic, greater than the empiricist, greater than the fruitive worker. Therefore, O Arjuna, in all circumstances, be a yogi. And then the last one, yoginamapi sarvesham madhvatenantaratmanam shravanvajateyomam samayuktatmomadaha. Of all yogis, the one with great faith, who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is the most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. So it's clear that Krishna is talking about a hierarchy. He's talking about a lot of possibilities. And here he's finally saying, this is what he wants Arjuna to do. And if you look at chapter 7, the first verse is, you know, now I'm going to describe to you this kind of yoga that I've been talking about, which is bhakti yoga. So from chapter 7 all the way through chapter 12, Krishna describes bhakti yoga. And then in chapters 13 through chapter 18, the last 6 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes how many of the principles in the other yoga systems can be useful in bhakti, and he describes how it can happen. So that's kind of how the Bhagavad Gita is laid out. When you understand that, it helps make the Bhagavad Gita make sense. Of course, we have to wait till chapter 18, text 60-something, I forget what it is, 67 or something like that. In chapter 18, then Krishna says, I have now described this process to you. Think on what I have said and do what you wish to do. That's what Krishna says. And then Arjuna replies, I have thought about what you said and I'm prepared to act according to your instructions. So at that point, you know, it's clear Arjuna got the picture and he's going to do what Krishna has asked him to do. So that's in the last chapter 18, where that happens, which shows you that if we go all the way from chapter 2, where Arjuna says, Govinda, I shall not fight, which is in chapter 2, we go all the way to chapter 18, toward the 60s somewhere there, where Arjuna says, now I've understood what you've said and I'm prepared to act according to your instructions. It means that he is going to fight. So there was a change in that period of time. Krishna's instructions caused Arjuna to change. And he accepted Krishna as spiritual master in second chapter, but in the 18th chapter, he actually voices his opinion that he's going to do what Arjuna says he should do. Well, what Krishna says he should do, Arjuna voices that opinion. Okay, yeah.
You were talking about the nine processes.
What's that?
About the nine processes.
Nine processes.
Nine steps.
Yeah.
Would we okay or would we get the same result if we start the first of them without faith or just doing them?
I'm not exactly sure what you're asking me.
No.
The first steps of them are. Just having knowledge.
Yeah, you're talking about the nine stages of devotional service.
Yeah.
There's also nine processes of devotional service. So we have to keep those separate.
So maybe at the beginning it's really difficult to have faith, right? And then.
Yeah, faith is something that becomes more and more steady as we get further along. Faith is hampered by sinful life in the past. That's why some people, they don't have any faith in God, no matter what you say. They have so much sinful karma in the past that when you tell them anything, they immediately have no faith in it. And this is a sign of a lot of heavy, you know, like bad activity in the past. But through devotional service, that bad karma burns away and our faith becomes stronger. And plus, we begin to see that the things we've talked about, the things we've heard, actually work. And so we have provisional faith in something, which is not pure faith, but it's provisional, and we give it the benefit of the doubt, let's say, and then we do it for some time, we see it actually works, it gives us greater faith, and we continue, and we reinvest, and eventually we reach these higher levels. I think pure is ready for...
No.
Okay, we have time.
Plate's still on the altar.
Okay. So, yeah,
you have... Thank you very much, Maharaj, for a wonderful class from yesterday evening here. Getting that lot of nectars. Question, that means clarification, that you mentioned about that these genuine feelings.
The what?
Genuine feelings,
yeah.
So that it comes, means after the prema?
Yeah, it begins to, we get installments in Atta Shaktis, you know, those are the higher levels of devotion. Actually, the devotional progress is divided into three categories. There is what we call sadhana bhakti.
Yes.
There's what's called raganuga bhakti. And then there's ragatmika bhakti. So those are different because of the nature of one's understanding and the nature of one's love. In the process we call sadhana bhakti, which is where most of us are in sadhana bhakti, we know what we should do. And we go through the motions, and sometimes we do actually genuinely experience happiness by doing devotional service. Sometimes we genuinely experience a feeling of love for Krishna. But there's so many things we do just because we know we should do them. We don't have genuine inspiration for that. And we don't have a constant feeling of, where is Krishna? How can I serve? You know, it's not quite at that stage yet. So because we have many unwanted things which are gradually destroyed by the process of bhakti yoga, our connection with Krishna is a little abstract, it's a little distant, it's a little formal. And so that whole category is called sadhana bhakti. Then really with Atta Shaktis begins what we call raganuga bhakti. And Atta Shaktis, that's where we become introduced to our relationship with God by bits and pieces. We get a feeling of it. We learn from devotees who are already in the relationship with God how we should act in our relationship. We get trained up, you know. In the beginning, we're trained up by devotees, those that are in the same temple or the same regions we are. But eventually, as we get into the deeper stages, we get trained up by people who are in their spiritual form, and they are training us how to connect with Krishna. And that's called Raganuga Bhakti. We are following in the footsteps of those who are already in their relationship with Krishna. And they may not be on this material plane at all. They may be completely in the spiritual plane. Although sometimes they may be in both. And then finally, there's Raghatmika Bhakti, where our spontaneous love for Krishna is already awakened. And at that point, a lot of things don't matter anymore. And by that point, we have a spontaneous desire to be with Krishna. And we are essentially in the spiritual world, even if we're still alive in this body. We're already there by that stage. And in that situation, we are connecting with Krishna on a daily basis, some kind of relationship with Krishna. Of course, that's a very high thing. We talk about these things like, you know, after a few days you go to one, and then after a few I just wish it was like that, but it really doesn't work that way. We're lucky if we make it to these higher stages, but at the time of death we may get Krishna's mercy and get promoted to the spiritual world, but even if we don't, we'll be promoted to another lifetime where we get a chance to perfect our lives to finally get to that stage, you know. So the process will be effective, and depending on how much we are intense and committed to the process is how quickly it'll work. It could even happen very soon and suddenly, and occasionally it does, but for most people it doesn't, because we have such strong attachments to the material world and we're so committed to our suitcase of stuff that we've carried around for so many lifetimes, you know. What we wanted to be, what we wanted people to think of us as, what we wanted to be seen as by the world, what we wanted to accomplish, what we wanted to visit, what we wanted to possess, what we wanted to control. When we finally throw this stuff overboard, then our suitcase becomes empty, and then we realize that what life is about is really loving Krishna. And so the devotional process pulls us through that whole progression.
Thank you.
So yeah, you have it.
Maharaj, you were talking about sadhana bhakti, that is what we are practicing, like
right.
We are practicing the devotional service. What is sadhya bhakti?
What's that?
Sadhya. Sadhana and sadhya.
Sadhya and sadhya. I think I read about that not so long ago, but somehow I can't remember the distinction between the two, sadhya, sadhana. One thing that's actually so much missing in modern religious thought is this idea of sadhana, that we do something not, you know, like we come to Janmashtami and we see the deities and we give them a banana. You know, that there's something more to spiritual life than that. Of course, that's good, it's nice, you know, or we come once a week or something like that. But sadhana is this idea that every day we do something for Krishna. And that involves maybe many things. And we have 9 processes of devotional service. So the most important pillar of sadhana is chanting Hare Krishna, because we are training the mind to focus on Krishna and to pull it away from many, many unwanted things that it's usually focused on. If we can stop the mind from focusing on so many material things, we find out that even without our working at it, the suitcase of material desires that we've carried around starts to just empty out. We don't even notice that it's happening, but it does happen. So by causing the mind to think about Krishna very often, especially if we follow the process of chanting Hare Krishna regularly 16 rounds every day, then that's a struggle. It takes about 2 hours. How many people in the world try to do something for God 2 hours every day? You know, not very many. You know, there's not even a concept of how you do that. What do you do for God 2 hours every day? But 2 hours of the day, or thereabouts, we're struggling to push other things out of our consciousness and trying to hear Krishna's name. So 2 hours of the day, we're doing something for Krishna. That's every day, not some days, not just Janmashtami or Christmas or whatever it happens to be. It's every day. And because we're making that effort every day, then we are getting a sense of religion is part of my everyday life. God or Krishna is a part of my everyday life, not of my once a year life. You know, he's part of my everyday life. And gradually we increase that. We do other things. We do service. We may do some kind of every morning program. You know, we're offering something, or we're attending a Mangal Arati, or we're attending something else. We're learning to think, how can I help other people become Krishna conscious? We're making some plan for that. We're doing some activity that involves that. And so in this way, this is sadhana. But most religions kind of make it real simple. You just join the right religion and everything is done. You know, it's all over. We wash our hands. We did the one right thing, and we can kick back and watch TV now because we did the right thing, the one thing that you have to do, and because everything else is automatically taken care of. But that's not religion. And anyone who's serious about religion knows that that's a very shallow comprehension of religion. The real thing is to daily do something for spiritual life, and that's sadhana.
Thank you.
So what you described earlier was nine stages?
Yeah. There are also nine processes of devotional chant, which is that's a different thing, yeah. There is Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Bandhanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Abhinividenam. Can somebody tell me, I'm sure somebody knows, what's one of the processes of devotionals? Don't name all nine, just one.
Shravanam.
What is that?
It's hearing.
Hearing, okay. So hearing about God.
Chanting.
Kirtanam, that's chanting. What's another one? Somebody else. In the back.
Surrendering.
What's that?
Surrendering.
Surrendering, yeah, that's up there in Atmanividenam. That's the top. We went to the top of the tree there.
Smaranam.
What's that?
Smaranam.
Yeah, Vishnu Smaranam. What is that in English?
Always thinking of Krishna.
Thinking of Krishna. So we have Shravanam, hearing, Kirtanam, chanting, Vishnu Smaranam, remembering Krishna. When we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're doing all three of those at the same time. We are hearing, we're chanting, and we're remembering. So that's why devotional service starts with those first three, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam. What's next? What have we left out so far?
Serving.
Serving, right. Padasevanam. So padasevanam means we're serving the Supreme, or we're doing activities for, what's another one?
Archanam.
Archanam, what's that?
Watching the deities.
Yeah, what somebody's going to be doing in a minute on the altar when you... That's archana, performing direct service for the Supreme Lord in the archa form, and that's called archana. What's one of the other ones?
Vandana.
What's that?
Glorifying.
Prayer. Offering prayers. So vandanam is offering prayers. And we've talked about, we're missing two, and there are more in the higher levels.
Dasya,
becoming a servant. That's dasya. And then sakyam, what is that?
Friendship.
Becoming a friend. All right. So those are higher levels of devotion. But we start with the lower ones, with Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam. And of course, we can easily do Padasevanam, Archanam, and Vandanam, those three. So that's six together. And our whole devotional idea of bhakti yoga means that we're trying to do one of those things at all times in one way or another. So sometimes we're hearing, sometimes we're chanting. Right now, I'm chanting, you're hearing. You know, and when we're chanting Hare Krishna, we're both chanting and hearing at the same time, remembering. Sometimes we are trying to remember something that we heard in Bhagavad Gita class, or we're trying to remember what Krishna looked like on the altar today, what kind of clothes he was wearing, what color it was, and all those things. Remembering, we come to the temple and we do cleaning, or we move things around, or we help repair something. This is padasevanam. We're doing service for the Supreme Lord in some aspect. And then sometimes, if we're second initiated, we may be called to do archanam. But in a sense, when we're hearing, when we're here and we're chanting and offering the artic prayers to Krishna while he's on the altar, that's also archanam. We're offering some songs to Krishna while he's on the altar, so that's also in one sense considered archanam. And vandanam is we're offering prayers to Krishna. We're asking Krishna for help. and many things like that. So Dasyam is becoming a servant of the Lord. That's a higher stage where we're committing our whole life to service of God, or becoming a friend. That's kind of getting into these, what we were talking about earlier, these higher stages where we become introduced and initiated into being a friend of God, and finally Atmani Bidenam, where we're giving everything to God. That's at the stages, you know, upper stages of pure focus on God.
I was thinking about that here in this, you mentioned about Krishna is saying don't disturb to the faithless person. And on the other side, Lord Nityananda, he's doing the same thing, opposite things, requesting to the people, jumping in the house. He is not thinking of in what conditions people are there in the house, just going chant the Hari name.
Yeah. So as I said, you know, we don't know what's behind the eyes of somebody that we're approaching. We don't know what they think or what they feel. When we give them a chance for Krishna, then they reveal what they think or feel. They like it, they don't like it. You know, if they don't like it, no use in making things worse. We can go away. But if they do, then we can help them to go one step further. I'm happy that I had a chance to talk about this verse, because there are some places that I've always kind of been a little confused about, but then today when I was reading this section, then it came to me clear what it is that's going on here, you know, that Krishna is talking about not wasting time with people who are committed to material life. But of course, if we give them one chance and then they're still committed to material life, then we shouldn't waste time with them. But if they're not, if they can take a step higher, then we should give them the time. And that's the way the Madhyamadikari works. You know, if someone is willing, they're Bali Seshu, you know, they're willing to take a step forward, then he's willing to spend time with them. If they reveal themselves to be Dvisatsu, envious, then we just ignore them. We go away. All right, so are we? Okay, so thank you all very much for your kind attention. All glories to Srimad Bhagavad Gita, all glories to Vaishnava, all glories to the Lord.
His Holiness Chandrasekhar Swami Maharaj ki
jai!